Thanks, Lynn. If I can follow up, so if all of the communications are in writing, and as you know, of course, then there's a robust dialogue, and oftentimes there's further inquiry by the audit committee about what the auditor meant by something that he or she put into writing. And if there's additional, obviously, explanations by the auditor about the matters during the committee meeting, would you expect then that those matters would also be then documented in writing and further shared with the audit committee or not?
Oh, I can think most recently of a conversation about what the auditor documented on the quality of the accounting practices, the very key critical accounting policies, and where they set the line. And in that particular case, there was one audit committee member disagreed with the auditor's assessment, and at the following meeting, there was follow-up by the auditor on that particular point. So, you know, I think it depends upon what the particular situation is as to what goes with it. I think some of Denny's comments are very relevant in this area. I don't think you want to get a 100-page document necessarily here. I think you want to get a document that really focuses on the key things. And again, I think a lot of your questions, a lot of your points are very key things, so I think they'll flow. But you don't want to have it turning into a CYA document. You want to have it turned into a real dialogue between the audit committee and the auditor. And then if there's things that are set up for follow-up, then so be it. In that particular board, we had a standard process for if something was like that got teed up, we would note it in a section of the audit committee minutes or the board minutes and note for follow-up. And the first thing we did at the next board meeting or audit committee meeting was always take on the follow-up items, because they're the things that people tend to forget about and drop through a hole. So we had a process for doing that. So we got back to them.
Thanks very much. Gary Kabrick?
Thanks, Marty. It, I'm going to sort of share some thoughts that were my comment letter, but also reading many of their comment letters here, I think, generally consistent with the preparers of the audit committee members here. And I think as a starting point, I would recommend anything of critical importance, you know, should be documented as a very strong general rule. And going back from experience more than once in my time as a preparer and going back far enough when I was an auditor, I can assure you more than once auditors documented something in the private memorandum of the file that no one else in the room remembered, or if they did remember, they didn't agree with the conclusion. We thought the answer was left and they thought it was right or whatever. So I think if nothing else, to avoid misunderstandings, to have a shared sense of the facts of the matter, it's important to have things documented. Now, I think there's some flexibility in level of documentation. So, like an example, you know, four times a year we do our quarterly earnings review with the audit committee. I mean, they get the thing the night before, and it's a bulletized list of the things we're going to talk about, you know, reserves, taxes, cash flow or whatever, but there's no details. But at least it's memorialized that you are going to talk about these subjects. Because that's real, you know, earnings release, 10-Q type releases, real-time stuff. And they only have five standing meetings a year where there's a couple hours long each, and the pre-read goes out 2 weeks earlier. And there's plenty of time for robust documentation. Again, I think it can take a lot of forms, a lot of levels of detail. So I would suggest if you're going to write rulemaking on this, the beginning assumption is it is documented, and maybe there's exclusions. I think of executive committees where you're talking individual staff qualifications and stuff. Maybe it's sufficient that you memorialize that the subject was discovered and not that it was discussed, but not necessarily the detail. You can probably process that in due course. But the other thing is I can truly see problems for the PCAOB, for the auditors and management down the line if you allow some things to be done orally and then there's a blow-up a year or two later and there was no requirement to share this critical dialogue in writing with the audit committee or the board of directors, as the case may be, again, along the lines of there's a shared understanding of the various views of the issue and the assessment of the facts of the issue. So I err on the side of more writing is better. Again, I think some flexibility about the level of detail.
Thanks, Gary. Denny?
I obviously prefer less than 100 pages of written documents, but having said that, if there is something that's important for the auditor to communicate, I think it's well to have it be in writing. And I think specifically of something like an important accounting issue that was communicated or consulted with the national office. Generally speaking, when that is the case, I ask the accounting firm or the company, usually the company, to write it up for the accounting firm so that we can have it in advance so that we can read about it before the meeting. These things are complicated, as I think Arnie indicated before, and generally speaking, if these things are just foisted upon the audit committee verbally at the meeting, the chances of the audit committee members fully understanding and being able to ask intelligent questions are fairly low. If we've had a chance to look at the material in advance and particularly then ask questions, maybe call or email in advance and ask for a little bit more elaboration if we wish to, there can be much more robust discussion and more effective discussion at the meeting. I think, Marty, the idea of having an after-the-fact follow-up with the material, in other words, having the audit committee receive the document of the accounting firm confirming the discussions kind of defeats the purpose. It seems to me that if we're going to have something in writing, those materials should go to the members of the committee in advance so that they can be part of the effective communication to lead to better discussions at the committee meetings and enhance the entire process for everyone.
Great. Thanks, Denny. Kiko?
Yeah, thank you, Marty. I'm having difficulty having sat in the room with audit committees and auditors and trying to figure out how we're going to operationalize this documentation of oral communications. It just seems problematic. Generally speaking, there's a free flow of communications. There's a lot of back and forth and questions and answers, and I don't see anybody other than the secretary taking the minutes of the meeting, who's a scribe in that process. So I find it difficult to do. That being said, I'm a big proponent of having material matters in writing. I don't like this thought of the auditors going back to their desks and documenting a whole bunch of discussions they had with the audit committee and then not share, or with management and then not sharing that information. So I would caution against that. I do think the matters that should be in writing, if they were oral, if you were going to go down that path, is anything that's obviously audit-related, audit conclusions, discussions about issues that they've settled in on one way or the other. And I do think that it should only be the important communications, certainly not the back and forth and casual communications that we have or we'll all have hundreds and tens of hundreds of documents to go through.
Thank you. Sam Renzilla.
Well, I think you run the risk of, if everything's in writing, of maybe reducing. One is, I think you run the risk of some boilerplate with some of the more sensitive issues. And I don't think it's boilerplate around things that would already be in the work papers. And the thing that sort of comes to mind for me that would be boilerplate might be around a discussion around your overall view of the quality of the company's financial reporting. Is it aggressive, ugly, whatever terms you might use. It's that sort of thing. I don't oral or written. I mean, if you're reaching a conclusion that the loan loss allowance is appropriately stated within the context of the financial statements taken as a whole, you're going to communicate, that's going to be in your papers just dead on. You're not going to be uncomfortable with reaching that conclusion. So I think it's around the more subjective areas. I think you run some risk associated with some boilerplate language around it. I don't know if that's the end of the world. We live in a legal environment where a boilerplate is sort of a fact of life. If all the communications are required to be in writing, you know what? At some point, we got to stop documenting everything that occurs. I think that's excessive to say, here are the requirements, put them in writing, and then anything discussion that you have around them also has to be documented. I could see, it's just anarchy. I think I'm making almost no progress on this, but I again am troubled by the writing of auditing standards meant to enhance the inspection of auditors. I don't think that's why. You write auditing standards to make it easier for your inspectors to do their work. And I'll leave it at that.
Marty, could I?
Were there any other comments? Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to make one suggestion. I'm agreeing with most of what was said about the value of written communications, but would you please, as you put this together, be practical and think about the realities of spontaneous communications and the advantages of something other than a written letter reviewed and all of those things. Maybe a PowerPoint slide or two might get the job done in a particular case. Just try to keep this as general as you can, still meeting whatever objective you're trying to accomplish. And particularly, while I agree 100% with what Denny said, it's so much more effective if you have it in writing, in advance, a chance to read it. But spontaneous communication in executive sessions and elsewhere is invaluable. And the last thing you want is somebody say, well, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you about that because I have to go put it in writing and I'll send it to you next week. So allow for subsequent documentation of conversations or as much flexibility as you can if you're headed down that road.
Thanks, Mike. Arnie Hanisch?
Yeah, Marty, just one comment. And I went back in preparation for this, I went back and looked at our auditor communications that take place already. And I guess it wasn't clear to me, and I hadn't commented previously, as to what problem are we trying to fix here with this issue. Because I look at the communications that take place between our auditor and the audit committee. It's, for the most part, everything fairly detailed and in writing, in advance, goes out in advance. It covers most of what everybody's talked about here. And I guess I question what's really broken in my mind with the way the communications are today in writing. You know, there may be ad hoc communications that take place that are not part of this document that take place or that gets sent out in advance. But generally speaking, the corporate secretary will minute a lot of that at a reasonably high level as to what takes place in the course of the conversations inside the audit committee meeting. And that seems to be, at least in my mind, an adequate level of documentation. If there was something additional that was critical that maybe wasn't captured, maybe that could be incorporated inside the minutes of the audit committee by the corporate secretary. I'm just not sure why you need to have the auditors writing voluminous additional memos for the files documenting maybe what was said in an ad hoc manner. So,
Arnie, just to respond to that briefly, we appreciate your comments. One of the things we considered in drafting this language was some findings that were reported in the board's 4010 report on triennially reviewed firms, and there were some instances where firms were not making all the required communications or it wasn't evidenced in any way in the work papers. So I think we tried to strike a balance between some firms that we see do a pretty robust, good presentation and a good job versus those who are not doing even what's required now.
I think I see two more, one card and one hand up here. So in keeping with the spirit of trying to get all of these topics covered, George Munoz, and then Alex.
Just very quickly, Arnie asked about, you know, what's broken, and I think we always have to ask ourselves that. But just did the PCAOB do a study on whether the accounting firms that audit the public firms that got in trouble, whether the accounting firms had any issues with their requirements that the PCAOB oversees was part of the problem?
I'm probably not going to answer the question anyway, but I wasn't sure I understood it.
Well, okay. I guess we got a proposal before us because somehow somebody thinks something is broken or could be greatly improved, and that's why it's worth the cost and worth all these extra procedures and putting things on the agenda. So I assume, did that stem from a study that the PCAOB did in terms of the fiasco that our companies went through a year and a half ago or so?
I'd say that the standard, the proposed standard on auditor communications with audit committees reflected a number of things, and that was observations from our inspections process, observations of some of the best practices we were seeing of where there were communications with audit committees, but they weren't in our standard, but that some firms were doing, but on certain engagements, but not on all. And observations from what other standard setters were doing. So there are a variety of things that input into our thinking as to this proposed standard. So I wouldn't say there was a particular study done, but a lot of variety of factors that influenced our thinking. All right, Alex, you're okay? Well, thanks for the lively discussion on this topic. I think it gave us a lot of things to think about regarding a subject that doesn't sound that complex about whether it should be written or oral, but there's a lot of strong views on it and a lot of differing views and balancing, I think, that comes into play as well. So thanks for your thoughts. The next topic is audit committee responsibilities in the engagement letter. The existing PCAOB standards require that the auditor establish an understanding with the client regarding the audit. And given changes in Sarbanes-Oxley, where the audit committee was put in the middle between the auditor and the audit client for the responsibility of the auditor dealing with the audit committee, we made a change, proposed change in the standard, that the auditor should establish a mutual understanding of the terms of the engagement with the audit committee in connection with the audit, as opposed to typically that letter was, or the engagement understanding was with management. And the mutual understanding includes communicating to the audit committee the objectives of the audit, the responsibilities of the auditor, responsibilities of management, etc. Several commenters actually stated that the mutual understanding should include the audit committee's responsibilities related to the audit as well, and that those responsibilities should be included in the engagement letter. And one commenter included in our briefing paper here on page 8 gave a number of suggestions as to what should be included in that letter. So that's the next topic of discussion, and that is, the question is, should the engagement letter include the responsibilities of the audit committee in addition to those of the auditor and management, and if so, what should those responsibilities be? And I've asked two people to address this topic, Bob Doerr and Jim Cox, and maybe Bob, you could start us off.
Sure, thanks, Marty, and actually I think this dovetails nicely with some of the prior discussion we've had around the effectiveness of two-way communication and other issues surrounding who does what in an audit and who's responsible. As we know, the proposed standard includes, among other objectives, objectives for the auditor to communicate to the audit committee the responsibilities of the auditor, and to, as Marty alluded to, establish a mutual understanding of the terms of the engagement, as well as to evaluate the adequacy of the two-way communication. Today, the engagement letter essentially lays out the responsibilities of the auditor and of management, but of course is currently void of any description of the responsibilities of the audit committee. And I hearken back to earlier today the description of the three-legged stool, and one of those legs are completely missing in the engagement letter. So in the spirit of promoting effective two-way communication, I think the question needs to be asked if whether or not a well-articulated and mutually agreed-upon description of the responsibilities of the audit committee contained in the engagement letter would actually facilitate or enhance in any way the effectiveness of the two-way communication. And if the answer to that is yes, I don't think, I'm quite sure the Sarbanes-Oxley Act doesn't go into any detail about what the responsibilities are other than for oversight of the audit process. But actually drawing from the proposed standard some of the items that were discussed there, I think the list potentially for the audit committee responsibilities is not long and not prescriptive other than, naturally to provide oversight to the financial reporting process, to inform the auditor about anything the audit committee knows that would be relevant to the audit would certainly be expected. And then getting into kind of some of the elements or criteria that were laid out that would be used in evaluating the effectiveness of the two-way communication could also be included perhaps in the engagement letter. Things like taking timely and appropriate actions and willingness to meet in the absence of management with the auditor, so on and so forth. So the question then in our mind is whether or not clearly articulated and mutually agreed upon responsibilities of all three parties in this scenario would actually enhance more effective communication. Thank you, Marty.
Thank you. Jim Cox?
Yeah, I think I can be brief. All the letters did point out what Bob was saying, and that is that all the letters commenting on the proposal, the importance of the engagement letter generally, and that the audit committee is missing from that from perhaps historical reasons. In a way, the audit committee is really not missing from that at all, because audit committees customarily have, I think the percentages are very high, a charter that sets forth what their obligations are. So when I looked at this proposal and thought about it, I was trying to figure out what would really be added by adding something to the engagement letter that was already in a charter that's at some location. The only thing I come up with is that the ritual is important, but I think that that's of momentary importance. It did make me think that that what would happen in the instance in which there was a audit of a firm that for some reason a very small group that didn't have a charter, at which point that then I think a reasonable auditor would then ask the questions about, well, what do you envision your role as, since it's not memorialized, et cetera. And if you just visit our website, we can provide you with a charter, and we can take care of this in a nanosecond. So at the end, being an academic, I'll end on this ponderous note, and that is I'm not sure what this would really address that wouldn't be already addressed in any fashion anyway through reasonable standards. It's not clear to me that it's a problem that's broken, nor is it a problem that's really missing something, this third prong of a stool, because it's in likely the charter.
Thanks for those comments. And let's take some cards around the table. I think, George, yours was up first.
Yes, thank you, Marty. I think I question if the engagement letter, which is a contract, now includes some obligations on the part of the audit committee on a contractual basis, whether there's a potential conflict with the fiduciary duty that the audit committee has to the and this contractual arrangement that it now has with the auditor, and what the real purpose of that is. And throughout this whole thing, what we have to keep in mind is that there are maybe 90% other ways that the audit committee is engaging with management, engaging with the board, engaging with other parties that the auditor is not in the loop for and does not need to be in the loop for. So somehow, you know, these requirements of reporting and communication and assessing seems to indicate as if the auditor needs to be present throughout all those situations. And I just would be cautious. I don't know what the answer is. But if there's a potential conflict of fiduciary duty with the contractual agreement, I think we have to be cognizant of that. It also sets a precedent. That is, once you include something in that engagement letter of, quote, obligation on the part, a contractual obligation on the part of the audit committee, you've opened up the door to that kind of add-ons, and it doesn't take long before the auditing, the auditors start saying, you know what, I want them on the hook, this, I want that, and next thing you know, so there's a potential conflict. Isn't the bottom line that the auditor here is supposed to be independent? That is, they call it as they see it. It's like an umpire. They come in, they do the work, they assess everything else, and they call it as they see it. There's a weakness, or there's a problem, or the audit committee is weak, there's an issue, and they report on that. And I think that's the way it should be stayed, as opposed to a contract, the way it's proposed.
Thanks. Well, just to be clear, in the proposed standard, there was not a requirement for the engagement letter to include responsibilities of the audit committee. That was a suggestion that was made by several commenters to us, just to make sure that that point was clear. Roger Coffin.
Thank you. I think that the innovation in Sarbanes-Oxley to put the audit committee in control of the audit process, in my judgment, was probably one of the most significant in corporate governance in a long time. And therefore, when I approach this standard, and what we're talking about now is the concept that you mentioned, Marty, of defining the roles of the audit committee in an engagement letter, I think in a perfect world, it has some attraction. And it sounds like a good idea, but the more that I thought about it, the more that I thought that the concept of the charter, for example, and which, by the way, I mean, anyone who takes a look at audit company charters will know how long and how defined they are. I mean, when I teach this in my class, I'll take a bunch of audit company charters and go through them with students, and they'll say, "You mean this is not a full-time job?" I mean, they're very lengthy, and When I think about how this might play out, and given that there are over 12,000 public companies, and thinking about what all these contracts might say, I guess I come down on that this might be a box that you might not want to go down. I think it's a fair question to ask, whether or not, you know, because you do want to have this concept that's clear and delineated, the what are the roles and responsibilities of all sides. But I think you have to leave the audit committee's roles and responsibilities to the governance process, that is to say, to the shareholders, as it's set forth in their charter, subject to various, you know, other rules of perhaps the SEC or the listing standards, and leave that piece out of it for want of just getting into something that is going to cause, I think, ultimately, the PCAOB more trouble than it's worth. Thank you.
Linda Griggs.
My only observation is that often these engagement letters are not actually something that's negotiated, unlike most contracts, which are negotiated and the words are worked out. You normally are handed an engagement letter by the accounting firm, and you take it or leave it. And when you try to raise comments, they're frequently rejected because this is our form. So while I think it would be a great idea if you really did have a back and forth and you sat down and the auditor said to the audit committee, "I'm really expecting you to do this, that, and the other," and you actually had a meeting of the mind and a mutual agreement on responsibilities, that would be great. In the real world, that won't happen. We'll be handed the engagement letter and we'll take it. So I think I'm with Jim. We've got a charter. The charters are very robust. If audit committees aren't fulfilling the terms of their charter, like I said before, it seems to me the auditors should sit down and talk with them and say, "Look, we think there's some inadequacies in our communication." But I don't think this is a way to do it.
Okay, thanks. I think we've gotten some pretty clear views on that question. And in keeping with our grand plan to get us on schedule and out of here by 3 o'clock, topic 6 on management communications, which we're going to ask Gary Kubrick to lead the discussion. Gary agreed with us that we've probably covered management communications extensively this morning as our entire discussion about communications and what should be communicated by management versus the auditor. So we're zooming right past topic 6, unless there's any objections, if somebody was really waiting to get a comment out on that. And we're going to topic 7 on... I'm sorry, Larry Salva.
Yeah, can I just ask a question? Because I noticed that in between paragraph 12 and 13, you had the note after 12 basically acknowledging things communicated by the management need not be repeated. But to the extent that management has covered anything in topic in paragraph 13, shouldn't that same guidance apply?
Larry, I think that the way it's bifurcated now leads to... We do believe what's in 13 should be communicated by the auditor because in most instances it represents the auditor's views. And so the auditor's views should be coming from the auditor. A few of the other matters in paragraph 13 are similar to the SEC requirements. The SEC requires the auditor to report critical accounting policies and alternative treatments under GAAP, and therefore we picked up the same type of language.
So paragraph 12 was more about the financial statements, critical estimates that were in the financial statements. 13 is more about the auditor's qualitative assessment of the adequacy of disclosures and the propriety of the accounting policies given the situation in the industry, et cetera.
I guess maybe I'll take issue with that and think that just as a general matter, especially if it's a collaborative kind of working relationship between auditor, audit committee, and management, that to the extent that the management has made a presentation, and often the audit committee will turn, the audit chair will turn to the auditors and ask them if they have additional comments, that's when we hear them, and if we don't hear them, then I assume that they're going in executive session and supplementing the comments if they don't want to make them in front of me. But I just think that to the extent they're made by management, they need not be repeated.
Thanks. And I agree, we've had a lot of input today about paragraph 12 requirements and who should make those communications and paragraph 13. So we've gotten a lot of valuable input on that during the day. Moving to topic 7. Jennifer?
Thanks, Marty. So the next and last discussion topic is on uncorrected misstatements. Just to remind everybody, the proposed standard requires the auditor to provide the audit committee with the schedule of uncorrected misstatements related to accounts and disclosures that was presented to management. We included this requirement in the standard because we believe it's consistent with the requirement of the SEC, which requires the auditor to report to the audit committee material written communications to management, and they include unadjusted differences as one of those items. In addition, although management and the auditor may have concluded that these misstatements are immaterial to the financial statements, misstatements could be material in future periods, especially to the extent they result from a control deficiency, which is not mitigated. So that's another reason we thought it was appropriate to share those types of issues for the audit committee's consideration. A number of commenters didn't object to this requirement. However, some did object to it and felt that the requirement result in providing the audit committee with too much detail on adjustments that do not have a material effect on the financial statements. So we're seeking views on whether or not this requirement should be included in the final standard. And we've asked Arnie Hanisch to open up the discussion with his views.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'll try to be brief. And the issues that at least I see around this center more on clarification of materiality. Well, I don't disagree at all. It's important that auditors provide a list of unadjusted misstatements, uncorrected misstatements to management as well as the audit committees. I just want to make sure that it's perfectly clear and concise within the proposal that this will be done based upon materiality levels. We all have thresholds that are provided to us. Auditors go through an analytical analysis as to what those thresholds will be, as to what would get communicated. It varies from company to company based upon the size of the company, income of the company, relative size of the balance sheet. I just believe that we need to be consistent in keeping with those levels of materiality and not necessarily encumber the audit committee with a degree of detail that would be, quite frankly, inappropriate as far as the level of some items which might be uncovered as part of the audit as uncorrected misstatements. I do believe that items that result or would have resulted in, if left uncorrected, significant deficiencies, material weaknesses, or could have suggested that there were trends from year to year clearly need to be communicated. And that's something that I believe needs to be made clear in the statement as well with regard to the impact that these left uncorrected would have on the degree of controls relative to significant deficiencies or material weaknesses. So that is pretty much the degree of comments that I wanted to make as far as introductory remarks to try to set the stage. It's not that I would necessarily personally object. I believe that it's important to have communications of that sort to to the audit committee. It's really the degree and the amount and the number of uncorrected misstatements. And I guess one other point is I would I don't believe it's necessary, again, unless it would result in a control deficiency and a significant control deficiency, to report to the audit committee those items that management has corrected that were discovered by management during the normal course of their audit. I think, quite frankly, if management finds things during the normal course, I'm sorry, not of its audit, of its closing process, to me that's a positive in the sense that management has the appropriate controls in place to detect items and has found them and corrected them appropriately. And again, unless it was pervasive and suggested that there was a control breakdown or a significant deficiency or material weakness in internal controls, other than that, I really don't believe it's necessary for an auditor to communicate those items that management has detected during its closing process.
Thanks, Arnie. Denny Beresford, see your card up.
I think this is a useful disclosure for audit committee members. The one thing I would ask you to consider adding in this case is some guidance on disclosures. That is, I've seen remarkable amount of inconsistency in my limited board experience on what information auditors feel they have to provide to audit committee members with respect to omitted disclosures. And I just don't think that people understand right now what the ground rules are. And in theory, I guess, if you went down the typical gap checklist, there could be scores, if not hundreds, of omitted disclosures on the basis of materiality. And that's clearly not going to be very helpful to audit committee members. But I think it is something that's not covered at all in the existing auditing standard, and I suggest that it's something that you should give some consideration to.
Can I ask a follow-up question regarding your last point on disclosures? I'm just curious if you've seen any or had any communications or best practices of how omitted disclosures would have been presented to you as an audit committee member or chair, and any suggestions in that area?
What I can say is that in one of my boards, one of the firms has simply listed omitted disclosures, said that these were ones that they thought were technically required under GAAP that were omitted on the basis of immateriality. In the other boards, there was no such listing. They just never said anything about any disclosures that were omitted. I don't know if any of the other audit committee members had seen any listings of omitted disclosures.
Thanks, Denny. Kiko Harvey?
Yes, I generally support the submission of the uncorrected misstatements to the audit committee. I think that's probably pretty common practice anyway. But on this matter of corrected misstatements, I agree that if management is identifying them as part of the normal closing process, I don't believe that those require any disclosure to the audit committee. The ones I would be a little bit more concerned about, though, are those that are caught that relate to a prior accounting period that's already been filed. Obviously, that would beg the question of whether or not that's an issue under ICFR. But I really, you know, I because of the materiality, I just don't know how that's captured in practice as well, and I would like to see some emphasis in that area.
Thank you. Just as far as your point on corrected misstatements that are picked up through the normal close process, we didn't include that as a requirement. It's just ones picked up by the auditor. So I think that's come up a couple times. George Muniz?
This is, I think, a good requirement, and that's because the audit committee is not only looking at the financial statement, the current financial statement, but it's evaluating it's evaluating management and it's evaluating the outside auditor. And so as it gets information about uncorrected misstatements or the like over time, so I would favor that it doesn't have to be material, because over time the audit committee can be in a better position to evaluate or judge the work and the interactions between management and the outside auditor, and even qualifications. So from that perspective, I would not restrict it only to materiality, but this is a good requirement.
Thank you. Gary Kabrick.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'll be quick. First of all, I'd like to echo Arnie's comments on stuff found by management in the ordinary course of the close, which will be hard to define what is an ordinary closing adjustment versus sound controls versus something that's a significant deficiency or material weakness, which probably should be brought to the auditor's attention and to the audit committee's attention. And I do support a SUD, you know, being presented to the audit committee. We're actually hanging on the one word, the same schedule of uncorrected differences. I don't think that's, you really mean the same schedule. Looking at us as a multinational company, there's many schedules at subsidiary and business unit levels, and some of which you've got posting significance of a very small dollar in a small subsidiary because, you know, a statutory audit report's coming, versus what affects the consolidated financial statements taken as a whole. So I would be careful in the use of the word same. And then likewise, even if it's the same items, the one presented to management might be at a more granular level of detail as what specific account number does it belong to. And again, that's sort of irrelevant at the consolidated level. So just be careful in the use of the word same. And my last comment regarding, we'll call it, disclosure omissions. The FASB, as you know, may know, has a project on disclosure framework and what should a disclosure framework look like. And one of the things that the working group is wrestling with is what is the answer to the question? As you know, every FASB standard, the last box said, you know, this can be omitted. You know, doesn't have to be applied to individual items. Well, does that mean if you omit it, it's perfect, it's GAAP? Or does it mean it's still not GAAP, even if it's small, but we're just not going to make a big deal out of it? And they're wrestling with what is the answer to that question. If you say if it's immaterial, and the conclusion is it's GAAP to omit it if it's immaterial, then there is no issue. So they're wrestling with that. My only advice, Jennifer, and what it would be to sort of stick close to the FASB's project team on this. I don't know where they're going to come out, but they are working it.
Thanks, Gary. I wanted to comment on one of the things you said, which was the word same. I think you were suggesting that maybe not the same schedule needed to be presented to the audit committee as management. And the way we drafted the requirement and the proposed standard is it is the same. We were aware of some instances, have concerns or could be others, that a different type of schedule might be, you know, would be presented to the audit committee that is misleading to the, you know, that may net some of the adjustments that appear better than it really may have been or just isn't giving a true or fair presentation of what happened. So that's the reason why we use the word the same, so that that might not happen. But. Lynn Turner?
I'd just like to say I agree with what Denny was saying about a list of omitted disclosures. I think we've seen times where people that left information on pension plans out of footnotes and that type of stuff, and so requiring that I think would be helpful in addition to the unadjusted entry score sheet, which I would have just the auditor things on it. I agree with Arnie, I wouldn't throw everything on it that management finds. I think that's part of the overall internal control analysis. So
thank you. Mary Hartman Morris.
Thank you, Jennifer. I just wanted to point out a couple of things that people have said, and that was I do agree that it should be included on uncorrected misstatements, and it should be provided to the audit committee, because I think that all of us have gone through, and you know, different divisions have to go through and correct or look at some of these issues and deal with it through management. And I don't know necessarily the audit committee sees the big picture and, you know, the cumulative effect. And so I think that that would be helpful, because I think it was brought up about whether or not there's some trends or pervasiveness. So I think that, you know, just seeing that, you know, it's not something that the audit committee has to deal with a lot or work with it, but just seeing that year over year, they might get that feeling of, okay, are there some issues that are underlying that need to be addressed? So I think that is important.
Thank you. Arnie?
Hey, Jennifer, just one point of clarification, and just to make sure that I didn't misrepresent anything in my opening remarks, that we're talking about here, at least what I'm talking about, are those items that are above what I'll call the threshold. That, I mean, I would hope that we're not looking to have the auditors, again, just to restate what I said earlier, that we're hoping I'm hoping we're not looking to have the auditors provide whatever detailed list there might be of things that are below a certain threshold. I think it's important to, in the aggregate, maybe indicate to the audit committee what those items were. I think it's important to indicate if they were all going one way. But if they were below the threshold, and the aggregate was not above a threshold that had been established for levels of materiality, I guess it troubles me that we would provide that kind of list of what I would consider to be very immaterial, especially if it was in the aggregate below the level of materiality that had been established, either at the balance sheet level or the income statement level.
So. Our standards on evaluating audit differences, materiality, would indicate that the auditor would record those things that are above being considered clearly trivial. So if it's clearly trivial, it does not need to go on the list. But otherwise, individually in the aggregate, if it's above clearly trivial, then those type of things would be recorded. So that might help some of your concern. Paul Schroeder?
I was just going to add, having gone through that enough times in my 13 years of auditing, there tended to be some games that got played with this type of issue. Well, we'll put this on the schedule. We won't put this on the schedule. What are we going to say? Is it judgment? Is it just application? Is it a factual error? Is it a misapplication of accounting? There are all sorts of different types of these misstatements, and I'm clearly in the camp of this is a good at some type of summary level telling an audit committee. We had generally these types of issues, half of them fell in the judgment, half of them fell in the systems or cutoff issues, whatever, just to give them a sense and feel, because I think it's a strong educational purpose. You know, certainly not providing all of the individual layers and detail, but some high level, I think, just a good education.
Did you? Don Nicolaus?
Yeah, I would just echo that. I think one of the things that is helpful, one of the things that's not helpful is a whole lot of data that gets provided, photocopies of schedules that are uncorrected errors and misstatements and missed omissions and whatever else that are just sort of dumped on the audit committee. It's a sort of the same thing where there's random walks through. We've got a lot of estimates, and the estimates are difficult, and it could be this or it could be that. What you're really looking for, at least what I'm really looking for from the auditor, is some interpretative guidance that says, this is meaningful. We've never seen this many errors in that have gone uncorrected in our history of our firm. You really ought to deal with this. That's helpful. To just dump them on us and say, here's a bunch of stuff that we found during our audit, and we photocopied it, and here you are, and we're required to give this to you, I'm not sure is a particularly meaningful exercise.
Don, was that a real-life experience you were?
No, but it could happen. You never know.
Charlie?
Yeah, just one follow-up comment related to disclosure, and I appreciate, Gary, your comments about FASB's project. I just want to highlight this because I think disclosure is going to become a big challenge when it comes to determining materiality. I'm not sure there's any real set rules on that, the way that we deal with misstatements and correcting numbers. And one thing about FASB, I'm not sure that FASB has the ability to actually determine what is material in that regard, even though it may present some interesting information about that. In the end, I think what a reasonable investor believes is material under the securities laws is what's going to be governing. And it's just, I only point that out because I think this is an area that's going to be a moving target. What may have deemed to be not material as a disclosure item may actually become material in the near future.
Mary, you had a comment?
Yeah, I would just make the point in terms of a summary of past disclosures, if you will, is that I think what drives that, at least in my experience in seeing what the auditors put on our lists, are the things that are clearly not the ones that are getting there because they're immaterial disclosures and they agree with that conclusion, and that it's not a tough conclusion to get there. It's the ones where there is a bit of judgment involved in reaching that conclusion that omitted disclosure is not significant to a potential user of the financial statements, where I think there's a judgment being made by the auditors as to what they post onto that schedule. There are clearly, like, we've taken approaches that I've discussed with the SEC staff of not making every required disclosure in our pension footnote because we have frozen pension plans and it's just not all that significant, but we make certain disclosures there, and the auditors, you know, will reference that point because that's kind of somewhat aggressive position, not quite. I don't think it's aggressive at all. I think that's using the box at the back of the standard that says if it's immaterial, don't include it. But that makes it onto the list. There are a few minor other things that make it onto the list, but they're clearly not putting every item that shows up on the disclosure checklist where they've made a note that said it was immaterial.
Thanks, sir. Mike?
Very quick observation on this one, but I could have made this observation on at least a half a dozen items before this, would be, I think it would be just fine to say that the auditor should reach an understanding with the chairman of the audit committee or with the audit committee on the degree of information and detail prepared here or provided here to meet the needs of the audit committee within the boundaries of the standard. And then if you wanted to go on and say in the absence of such an agreement you can or can't give the same schedule, it's true of so many things I think we've been talking about, is really kind of wonder why the auditors or the standard setters for the auditors are deciding what the audit committee ought to get, as long as the standards are complied with. And I'm not suggesting anything different than that, but right in this one, just talk about it. See what it is that the committee needs and provide it. It doesn't seem too difficult.
Thank you. I
I think, Mike, you ended the session on that for us, and I don't see any other 10 cards. We are getting close to 3, which is our closing time, so we'll move into the wrap-up section, and I'll turn it over to Dan Gelser to provide a wrap-up and summary.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Marty did have to leave early because of a family matter and asked me to do the wrap-up, but I am going to be mercifully brief. I think we've had a very busy and active day, and so the only wrap-up I would like to give is to thank everyone for their participation, for their advice, and for the ideas that you've given us. I think we certainly have a lot to think about in terms of the standard. I don't know if I would go so far as to say that there was a consensus on anything, except possibly whether the audit committee's responsibilities ought to be described in the engagement letter or not. But we certainly will carefully consider everything that we've heard here today, and I think you'll see the results of this meeting as we go forward with this project. As I said in my opening remarks this morning, I think the success of our standard setting is very much dependent upon the willingness of those who have firsthand experience the matters that we deal with to give us the benefit of their views and advice. And from that perspective, I think this has been a very effective roundtable. So again, thank you very much to all of you, and I will adjourn the roundtable.
Thank you.
Thank you.